This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Thousands of government officials, corporate executives, public relations experts, and climate activists have convened in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for the United Nations' 27th Conference of Parties to tackle climate change. The annual gathering, meant to yield concrete progress on phasing out fossil fuels and ushering in a just transition to renewables, has ended in gridlock more often than not. This year, for the first time, oil and gas companies were invited to officially send representatives to the COP. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden addressed COP27 attendees and apologized for his predecessor's decision to pull out of the Paris Accords, which were signed at COP21. We turn now to Andrea Nika Morris, President and Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So as you're watching the proceedings in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, are you feeling what I think a lot of folks are feeling is, here we go again, we're going to get a lot of hype, a lot of talk, and probably, very, very likely, not much else, not much progress?
Well, we have a little bit more hope here in Louisiana because there's activity on the ground here in Louisiana that we certainly hope will complement any investments being made already by the Biden-Harris administration in the form of the investing in the IIJA, the infrastructure bill, and then the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as the ARPA dollars that have already been put out there. There's already funds that can be addressed. There's going to be some Department of Energy grants that can be made available, because we believe that starting with making homes net zero is a great first start to talk about addressing climate change. We need to be investing in people in frontline communities in the global South who are struggling with everyday issues, and that climate is a part of that. Climate intensified hurricanes and wildfires and other issues are making their lives, their everyday lives, just a little bit more hard. And so investing in those issues, finding that intersection between climate and other issues like housing is the best first step. And investing in people, making sure that they understand their voices and accountability. So while there is cause for skepticism at what's going to come out of the COP and what we're going to see moving forward, there's hope still. There's an opportunity for the people to make the right change, to make the right pivot, and to demand that those promises are not false promises, that it's not simply hype.
Now, President Biden has, in response to criticism that gas prices were too high, released gas reserves. He's called for basically flooding the oil and gas market in order to bring down prices. But that's the opposite of what climate justice activists like yourself are calling for, right?
Right. I mean, again, fossil fuels are a limited resource, and continuing to rely on them is a losing strategy. We know that in the long run. But again, looking at the everyday needs of people across the global South and whether or not they can pay their bills today, whether or not they can get to work today, doesn't make them climate change activists, doesn't make them understand these issues in the long run. And so we've got to find that delicate balance. We've got to be pivoting to renewables. We've got to be talking about making the investments that allow for the smart strategic decisions to move away from fossil fuels. But we can't ignore the everyday needs of people in pursuit of climate change strategy. That's a losing strategy. We've seen that play out. High-minded ideals that don't recognize the needs of everyday people on the ground don't land, right? And we need to have hard conversations. We need to know how to talk to people and get them to understand that some of the decisions that they're making is actually making their circumstances worse, right? But they need real options. We can't just offer people platitudes. We can't just offer people scarcity measures and that they should suffer when they're already suffering. So that is the delicate balance. And again, we've got to teach our leaders how to also walk that delicate balance themselves, not simply do things that might seem popular, but also do things that are strategic and impactful in the long run. We want to build resilient communities, not just relying on people in the global South to themselves be resilient and take blow after blow after blow.
Now, India's representatives at COP27 have called for a phase down of fossil fuels, saying that this is in line with the COP21 Paris Accords that were signed, 6 years ago, that the US had been party to and then pulled out of under the Trump administration and has now rejoined. And yet at this COP27, oil and gas executives were invited officially for the first time. And of course, not only have the number of delegates from that industry gone up, the number of lobbyists have gone up. In fact, there was one report that there were more representatives of the oil and gas industry at COP21 in Egypt than climate justice activists. What do you make of that?
Well, and that's troubling and challenging, but I do know that more people from places like Louisiana who are climate justice warriors who don't just necessarily do that, right? We had partners there who work on things like election engagement. We had partners who work on the front lines around cultural economy and the rights of Native New Orleanians and indigenous people who had never been there before. So while there was an unfortunate increase in oil and gas executives and their lobbyists, there was also a significant increase in new people to this fight, people who live with the consequences of that. And we've got to make sure that their voices are being heard. We've got to make sure that they're getting the messages, they're getting the information from the COP conference and bringing it back to their communities, educating and helping those community members activate and put in place investments, put in place elected officials who will actually honor the strategies that are necessary to move this agenda forward. We don't have a lot of choices other than to deal with the circumstances on the ground, the circumstances as they exist today and tomorrow. But we can be strategic about it. And we also have to recognize when there are people who unfortunately are going to be organizing against the will of the people, against the needs of this planet. We've got to identify them. I, for one, would rather see people face to face rather than being off scurrying behind closed doors, doing God knows what to undermine this agenda. It's easier to fight in the plain light of day.
Now, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International just released a few weeks ago a report on the gendered and racial impacts of the fossil fuel industry in North America and complicit financial institutions. I know that you've endorsed this report. What are some of the highlights that we need to pay attention to as we're watching the proceedings at COP27 unfold? Because the climate crisis affects some people disproportionately based on their demographics, right?
Right. Like so many issues that are facing us in the United States, too many of these issues are colored by race and gender. There are threats. This is a crisis for the entire planet, obviously. But unfortunately, people who are victimized by systemic barriers, by systemic biases, suffer more. And again, we see this with the intersection around climate intensified hurricanes, wildfires, other risks, even the pandemics. These things all hit the most vulnerable even more so. And nowhere do you see that more than in the needs for Black women and their children in housing in places where climate intensified storms affect, where they're dealing with record heat or record cold, where they're dealing with substandard housing to begin with. And they feel these crises first. The resulting insurance spikes and mortgage increases also hit them first. And so this report confirms what we already know, that these issues do not affect people equitably. And so this is why it's important to educate and engage and activate those folks on the ground so that they can turn and fight on behalf of their communities with their elected officials and even against their elected officials to make sure that we have a strategy to address climate change that centers their needs, not simply notions and ideas that don't actually help their everyday lives, much less make sure that their children can be here or that their communities that they've cherished for generations will still be here.
Now, one of the issues that a lot of climate justice activists internationally have raised is that not everybody is equally responsible for creating the crisis in the first place. This has been a huge sticking point for years at the UN COPs, which is that the rich countries should be paying for the damage they've done. Then again, there's all sorts of complications because the governments of the poor countries too are often, you know, hosts to inequality. And so then you've got citizens of those poor nations at the COP to hold their governments and rich governments accountable. There's a lot of dynamics in play, but the overarching frame tends to be the fact that we live in a very, very unequal world where government elites and corporations are at the top and the majority of the people are at the bottom. But that framing gets lost. It becomes a sort of rich countries, poor countries, but it really is rich people, poor people, right? Or rich institutions.
Well,
poor
and people. It's nuanced also as well, right? It's we can't step away from the complexity. We cannot abandon that. We cannot, and we also, this is how systemic biases works, right? You recognize that there's an inequity, and then because it's going to be complicated, there's a worry, and then there's also a notion of fair and unfair that has nothing has to do with quantifiable data. It has to do with how people who have privilege feel. And we've got to stop doing that. We've got to stop having these conversations about people's feelings, and talk about people's lives and talk about people's communities existing for the next 30, 50, 100 years, because that's what's at stake here is, who is at the most risk? Who can interrupt? And that might be the issue that we talk about instead of removing the idea of blame, because that provokes feelings, right? You if you're blaming someone, you want them to feel accountable. You want them to own it. But beyond all of that, who has the best opportunity to actually affect the kind of change that is necessary? Who has the best resources to implement a strategy that helps the most people? That may be the better way to talk about this instead of blame and responsibility, even though we know there's plenty of blame to go around. And we do need those folks to acknowledge that because of luxury, because of resources, because of opportunities, there are responsibilities, not just for their citizens, not just for their neighbors, but for the planet.
Andrenika, what about issues that impact your organization or that your organization works on? You referred to them a little bit earlier. New Orleans is home to a sizable Black and Indigenous population. It is also the site of one of the earliest major hurricanes.
Yeah, the mother of them.
The Hurricane Katrina that really was a wake-up call to so many people the impacts of climate change. And I imagine those effects are still being felt.
They absolutely are. We call Katrina the mother of the modern disaster era. It ushered in the last 17 years has been crisis after catastrophe, after disaster, after pandemic. On and on and on, not just in South Louisiana, but across this country. And unfortunately, this country didn't heed the warning that Katrina offered, that Hurricane Katrina offered. The world looked to New Orleans and saw the inequity and saw the results of government disinvestment and mismanagement of resources, as well as we're continuing to deal with the inequitable way the resources have been allocated. Communities that were seen as ground zero for Hurricane Katrina still aren't back. The people are still displaced. We are still over 100,000 people off our pre-Katrina population, which was still down 100,000 over 125,000 our major our all-time high, which was almost 50 years ago. So, and again, a lot of those things were ushered that decline in population around white flight, the emergence of African Americans as their own political power, and then the oil and gas boom, right? People forget about that's something that hit New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina. We saw disinvestment and depopulation due to the oil and gas boom. So we've known for a while how foolish it is to rely on fossil fuels as an economic engine, but we've still not made the the correction. We've not made the just transition that we need to in order to preserve our culture, to preserve our communities. And that's what New Orleans has to offer everyone, is what not to do, and a pretty darn good roadmap on what to do as well. We do have a roadmap on what to do, but mostly we are a cautionary tale on what not to do. And unfortunately, the rest of the United States isn't listening to that. They're not, the other communities are dealing with the same issues and not learning from those hard fought lessons, those hard learned lessons from New Orleans.
Finally, Andrea Nika, draw the connections then between the work that you do on the ground in New Orleans, in the, you know, richest country in the world, and, you know, so one of the poorest communities within one of the richest countries, if not the richest country, with China for the top spot. Draw the connection between that and the negotiations in COP27 for us.
So again, you know, we've talked about this before. New Orleans is in many ways an example, the canary in the coal mine, on how what's coming for the rest of the country and for the rest of the planet if we don't interrupt this cycle. And so because there are so many low to moderate income folks here, folks who have been disinvested in, and that's because of the color of their skin, not the context of their character, not their willingness to work. It is systemic racism at play in a city that is beloved across the world. And that also speaks to the helplessness that is currently gripping a lot of our strategy, right? People love New Orleans. New Orleans is known internationally. So why isn't New Orleans and New Orleans is at risk, like far too many southern cities in the southern and the global south. We're far too at risk for what's about to happen with climate change. So everyone loves us, but we're not willing to make the investments necessary, the sacrifices that are necessary, take the responsibility that we have, that our neighbors and our partners and our community members, other states have, other countries have, to right this ship. We're not, the United States is balking at doing what's necessary to save New Orleans. That's a tough juxtaposition for us to grapple with, but grapple with it we do every day. So part of what we do on the ground is to work with community, to work with partners, to work with elected officials to understand what is at risk and what can be done. We must activate, we have to engage, and then we have to hold our decision makers accountable around these decisions. And for us, it starts with guaranteeing housing that is safe, decent, affordable, and resilient. That means the home needs to be energy efficient. It needs to be built in an area that is safe for that family, where they can have access to resources, and that they can then, they know the value of having a home that is net zero. They know the value of having a home that is close to opportunities. They know the value of having a home that they can afford, and they know that they know if they have to evacuate for the storm, they will be able to evacuate, and they will have a home to come back to at some point should the worst happen. That creates the kind of climate warriors, the kind of independent and thoughtful citizen who can then hold their elected officials accountable for the next leg of this work.
Thank you so much, Andrea Nika, for joining us today. Give out a website for your organization, the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance.
Sure, it's www.gnoha.org, GNOHA.org.
Thank you so much. We'll post a link to that from our website. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Andrea Nika Morris, President and Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance, and we've been talking about the COP27 proceedings in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.